the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. A government whistleblower says President Trump tried to coerce Ukraine and that the White House tried to cover it up. The impeachment inquiry football is now in the hands of Adam Schiff and the House Intelligence Committee. We'll hear what one of his purple district colleagues thinks should happen next. Plus, why California is insisting everyone put down their vape pens. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for choosing us this Thursday. It was another busy news day, but fear not. We will lighten up toward the end of the show. I promise. A little comedy. Paula Poundstone will join us a little bit later. But we are going to start today with the big news of the day, and that's the U.S. House Intelligence Committee, chaired by California Congressman Adam Schiff, releasing that whistleblower's complaint today. It centers on President Trump's July 25th call with his Ukrainian counterpart, the transcript of which was made available Wednesday. In a nutshell, the complaint claims the president misused his office by trying to pressure Ukraine into helping his 2020 re-election campaign, and that White House officials tried to, quote, lock down records of the phone call. The acting director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, testified this morning before the House Intelligence Committee addressing the complaint. Here's McGuire along with committee chair, California Congressman Adam Schiff.
I think the whistleblower did the right thing. I think he followed the law every step of the way, and we just got stuck with it.
Then why, Director, when the president called the whistleblower a political hack and suggested that he or she might be disloyal to the country, why did you remain silent?
I did not remain silent, Mr. Chairman. I issued a statement to my workforce telling and committing my commitment to the whistleblower protection and ensuring that I would provide protection to anybody within the intelligence community who comes forward.
And speaking from an airfield, President Trump didn't directly respond to the allegations leveled toward him. Instead, he said that it's all a political ploy by the Democrats.
It's a terrible thing for our country. They can't do any work. They're frozen. The Democrats are going to lose the election. They know it. That's why they're doing it.
To review all this and to give you a sense of how this could play out over the next few weeks and months, we're joined now by Ellen Nakashima, national security reporter for The Washington Post, and Stephen Bladek, professor of law at the University of Texas. Ellen, Stephen, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Ellen, let's start with you. And for those who maybe missed some of the earlier testimony, what did we learn today?
Well, the acting director of national intelligence, Joseph McGuire, became the first administration official to testify publicly and at such length about the substance of the whistleblower complaint and the process he took to get that complaint to the Hill. It was a tense 3-hour hearing in which, in a way, you saw Congressman or Chairman Schiff test out or try to air arguments that could be used in an impeachment hearing, eventually impeachment hearing, whereas the Republicans were really trying to deflate all of those arguments and accuse the Democrats of just exploiting all of this for political purposes. We learned that Joseph McGuire believed he was doing the right thing, that he said he really, in the end, wanted to get this, was working to get this complaint up to the Hill, working to make it public, but his hands were tied by an Office of Legal Counsel or Justice Department opinion that said that the substance of the complaint was not something within his purview, was not within his responsibility and authority, and as such, he was not required to transmit it to the Hill. And at the same time, he had consulted the White House. In fact, he went to the White House first about concerns over executive privilege.
And that's now, what makes this unprecedented, right, in that he didn't go directly to Congress with the complaint.
That's right. This is so much about this. This is all unprecedented that the IG, the Inspector General, I believe, has never received a complaint before that where the subject of the complaint is the President of the United States. The laws that govern these sorts of things don't contemplate that sort of situation. And then you have this DNI who's new in the job, barely a month on the job. He's not a lawyer. He's not well-versed in all of these areas. And here he is stuck with, you know, hot potato comes into his lap. What does he do? Well, because he feels that that this conversation between the president and the president of Ukraine would be subject to privilege, he decides to go and consult the White House. And that triggers the outrage and ire of the Democrats.
Stephen Bladick, a professor of law at the University of Texas, what was your takeaway from this morning's testimony?
Well, I actually think that most of the more important things that happened today were not in the hearing itself, but were some of the other documents that were released, including, you know, the full whistleblower complaint that provoked this whole affair, the Inspector General's assessment of the complaint and why he found it credible. And frankly, I think the most important thing we saw today was the original memo from September 3rd from the Office of Legal Counsel on why it had instructed the acting DNI not to transmit the whistleblower report to Congress, which I think poked some pretty big holes in the memo that we got from Ilsa yesterday. So, you know, I think the real question I have is, at what point does this conversation shift from the process by which we all learned about not just the president's phone call, but these other affairs, you know, going on behind the scenes, to the actual substance here? I mean, the whistleblower complaint talks about other calls between the president and foreign leaders that were potentially, you know, unlawfully rerouted from the general storage system the White House uses for these kinds of high-level diplomatic calls to, you know, the special system for top-secret calls. And I think, you know, the one thing that came out of the hearing and these other disclosures today is that there's a lot more we need to know. There's a lot more that I think, you know, we have a right to hear about. There's a lot more for Democrats, and I would hope Republicans, to want to find out about exactly, you know, the full sort of range of what's in the whistleblower complaint, not just the one phone call, you know, that we have the MemCon from yesterday.
And just to put the where they put the call, the details of the call in context, fewer eyes, right, Stephen, would be able to see it where it was.
Right. So the there are multiple different systems in the White House, you know, for recording this information. The sort of more sensitive system exists to ensure that, you know, phone calls that discuss, for example, covert operations, calling a foreign leader to ask for permission to use their airspace for some kind of top secret military mission, that those are not circulated as widely. Those are not available to, say, the entire national security staff in the White House, but just those with the need to know. The whistleblower complaint specifically alleges that White House counsel's lawyers, lawyers in the White House counsel's office, instructed different White House officials not just to put this call, the one that we now know a lot about, in this more secure system, but other calls for political reasons, not because they actually justified the special treatment, but entirely to hide the potentially damaging information from those who might not be fully on board with President Trump. And, you know, that's not just a violation of White House communication protocols, if so, but it also makes you wonder what's in those additional phone calls that led the White House counsel's office to go to such measures.
Let's get to that information for a second from the whistleblower, because that was one of the biggest issues, is that the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, Michael Atkinson, whether he vetted it properly. And that was brought up when a New York GOP Congresswoman Elise Stefanik questioned McGuire.
On page one, the complaint reads, quote, "I was not a direct witness to most of the events described." This seems like a very important line. Did the IG fully investigate the allegations into this complaint at this time? Has the IG fully investigated the allegations in this complaint?
As I said earlier, Congresswoman, I believe that the Intelligence Community Inspector General did a thorough investigation with the 14-day time frame that he had. And under that timeline, to the best of his ability, made the determination that it was both credible and urgent.
Stephen, not being a direct witness, how big of a detail was that from today?
So, you know, I mean, we had already had that reported, although only through anonymous sources. I think that's an important point for those who are trying to say that what the whistleblower is reporting is hearsay. But on the flip side, I mean, we do now have at least the MemCon, the memorandum memorializing the conversation between the president and Zelensky. And if you actually hold up how the whistleblower complaint describes that conversation with what the White House itself released yesterday, it's pretty darn close. And so I think, you know, folks should obviously decide for themselves what they think about the credibility of the whistleblower. You know, the Inspector General, Michael Atkinson, who we should say was appointed by President Trump, I think was not just relying on, you know, the secondhand account relayed to him by the whistleblower in the complaint, but by other witnesses to the conversation. And, you know, one would think that if this were really a problem, folks would be pointing to the discrepancies between what the whistleblower complaint says happened on the call and what we've been told happened on the call. No one's doing that. I think that's actually a pretty powerful sign that there's a lot of support for what the whistleblower complaint describes and what the White House has voluntarily released.
Talking to Stephen Vladek, professor of law at the University of Texas, and Ellen Nakashima, national security reporter for the Washington Post. Ellen, what can you tell us about the Inspector General, Michael Atkinson? Who is he and what is his role typically in these sorts of matters?
Michael Atkinson is a career prosecutor, highly regarded, had been at the Justice Department for over 15 years as a trial attorney, and won a big corruption case against Congressman William Jefferson back in the Obama administration. He took office about in May of 2018 and is in charge of the He's the Inspector General for the intelligence community, and thus, you know, his remit covers the various 17 intelligence agencies. And in general, these Inspector Generals, Inspectors General handle cases, everything from, waste, fraud, and abuse to criminal matters to abuse of power, you know, everything from an employee having porn on their computer to more serious questions. Now, something like this involving a complaint about, president's abuse of power or use of his office for political advantage with a phone call to a foreign leader, that's unprecedented. I don't think, as I mentioned before, any inspector general has ever really ever encountered that situation. And in sort of these cases, these are rare, these cases of what they call this urgent concern matter. But in this case, Michael Atkinson did determine that the whistleblower was credible and that his concern met the statutory definition of urgent concern, as well as the common layperson's understanding of urgent.
All right. Now to the what's next of this, because Congressman Schiff really pressed McGuire on whether the whistleblower's claims should be investigated further, and McGuire kind of put it back on Congressman Schiff and said, hey, that's up to you and your committee. So, Ellen, where does the intelligence community's involvement end on this, and where does Congress pick it back up?
Well, I think the whistleblower's complaint provides a great roadmap for investigation, for further investigation here by the committee or committees. I mean, there's a name of a State Department official who was listening in on the call. The complaint says references at least half a dozen other officials who were advised of the call or had readouts who knew about these concerns. There are a number of other officials within the administration, both at the White House and other agencies, who would have firsthand knowledge of and concerns about what the president was doing, what his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, was doing in terms of trying to pressure the Ukrainians to open or reopen an investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden and his son. And their efforts to try to get rid of a former ambassador that they thought was unhelpful to the Trump administration. These are all sort of issues that the whistleblower brought up in his complaint in her complaint that the intelligence committees should and could now start to investigate.
Stephen, one last thing really quick. In the future, for the whistleblower, will we need to hear from that person at this point to add more credibility, or for the Republicans to maybe take away credibility from this?
I don't know that we need to hear from the whistleblower. I mean, the reality is that the whistleblower is not the story here. The whistleblower's complaint, to the extent that people find it to be credible, identifies any number of potential witnesses to the alleged improprieties and misconduct. So, I think there will be folks who want to hear from the whistleblower, him or herself, but the reality is I think the folks that Congress is going to want to talk to are the folks much closer to the underlying episode, the attorney general, folks in the White House counsel's office. And that's going to provoke, I think, yet another round of disputes over just how much power Congress has to compel these folks to come and testify, and whether, if they resist, we're going to see yet further litigation over congressional subpoenas against claims of executive privilege, attorney-client privilege, and the like. I think, this is going to there's a long way to go before we're going to know how this ends, but I think it's certainly, smoke that Congress is going to want to investigate to see if there's really a fire.
Stephen Vladek, professor of law at the University of Texas, and Ellen Nakashima, national security reporter for the Washington Post. My thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we just heard about what happened today and what could happen next. Now, California Congressman Harley Ruda. He supports the impeachment inquiry. The thing is, he is from a purple district in Orange County and has to run for his seat again next year. We're going to hear what he'll be listening for as all of this works its way through the House of Representatives. Harley Ruda coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Until this week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had been hesitant to explore impeachment. That decision was due in part to her concern about House Democrats in purple districts. But of the seven California Democrats who flipped seats last year, all of them have come out in favor of the inquiry. Yesterday, we heard from Congresswoman Katie Hill from Northern LA County. Today, we're going to hear from Harley Ruda. He represents District 48 in Orange County. Congressman, thanks for making the time.
Thank you. Glad to be on the show.
Now, a very tense moment as the House Intelligence Committee questioned Acting Director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire. What were your takeaways from that questioning?
I think the committee did a fabulous job of digging in deep on both the memorandum of the phone call as well as the whistleblower's report. And one thing that I think everybody walked away with is that a lot more investigation needs to be done here in ascertaining to what degree the President of the United States asked a foreign government to intervene on his behalf to basically get dirt on a political foe.
A lot of your Republican colleagues, though, had an issue with the whistleblower not having a firsthand account of the events described in the complaint. Is that an issue for you at all?
Well, it's not an issue per se, because the whole purpose of the whistleblower's report was to, in the case of the whistleblower, was to document what they had seen and heard. And while some of it was not seen firsthand, if anybody has seen the whistleblower's report, they will see it is incredibly well documented and raises numerous issues, not just the president's conduct on that phone call, but other phone calls and meetings that have taken place, as well as what very well might be equally discerning is the fact that the preparation of the memorandum of the phone call was moved from the server in the situation room, allegedly, to a server that is only used for absolutely classified materials relevant to national defense. And there was no reason for this memorandum to be moved off of the situation room server. So if in fact that did happen in an effort to cover up what happened, we should all be very, very concerned.
Talking to Congressman Harley Ruda, represents the 48th District of California in Orange County. And Congressman, if you could reposition your phone a little bit, we're having trouble hearing you a bit. So if you can do that, that would be awesome. I'm wondering what more do you still need to learn right off the bat? I know we still have a long way to go in this process, but right off the bat, what more do you want to learn on this?
I think what most of the committees are going to be working on, especially the Intelligence Committee, is working on digging in deeper on the whistleblower's report as to a multitude of information. The individuals that the whistleblower spoke with, getting firsthand from them what they saw and what they heard, understanding if, in fact, the memorandum was removed from the Situation Room server to another server, and if so, why. What exactly role did the White House and White House counsel and the Justice Department and the Attorney General play in reviewing the whistleblower report and making the decision not to take further action? A better understanding why the whistleblower's report was not provided to Adam Schiff and the Intelligence Committee within 7 days as required by law. And then there's a host of other issues as well. But those would be the top topics, I believe, will be on the the first part of the agenda.
One more thing, Congressman. You won your district by about 7%. So fair to say Republicans are still a very vocal part of your district. What's your message to those who might be angry about your support of this inquiry? And is that something that worries you, considering that you do have to run again soon?
You know, I've told people repeatedly, my decision to support an impeachment inquiry was based on the oath I took to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. And it's a very solemn moment when you do that. And I don't care if it was a Democrat or a Republican president, this kind of behavior demands all of us to put party aside and put country first. And that is why I took the action I took. And I will tell you, the district supports it. We've had approximately 1,400 emails and phone calls come in, and all but 100, approximately 100 of them, have supported the position I have taken. And the last thing I'll share with you on this, just on my flight back to D.C. this week, I was sitting next to a guy, and we had our usual pleasantries when you sit down next to somebody on the airplane, and we didn't talk again until the very end, but he had overheard somebody recognize me as a member of Congress, and as he stood up, he said, "I am an angry Republican, and I am so glad that you guys are taking action against this rogue president." I think that sums up how a lot of Republicans feel.
That's California Congressman Harley Reuter representing California's 48th District in Orange County. Congressman, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, moving on. The family of an unarmed man killed by an LAPD officer in a Costco store in June is holding a news conference at this hour. It's to denounce the decision not to file criminal charges against the officer. Riverside County District Attorney announced yesterday that neither he nor a grand jury is filing charges against Officer Salvador Sanchez in the killing of 32-year-old Kenneth French and the wounding of French's parents. The case drew national attention because French has an intellectual or had an intellectual disability. For a closer look at the decision and some of the new details about the incident, we turn now to KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Hello, Frank.
Hey.
First, remind us how this shooting went down.
Well, it was a Friday evening, and Kenneth French was standing in line to taste some free food at a Costco in Corona when he struck Officer Sanchez in the back of the head. We don't know what part of his body struck Sanchez, nor whether it was an accident or intentional. Remember, French's family has said he had an intellectual disability, that he was unable to communicate verbally, and that he could be awkward in public. Sanchez, who was off duty and holding his 18-month-old son, fell to the ground and opened fire. The French family claims that his parents pleaded with Sanchez not to shoot and told him Kenneth had an intellectual disability. Sanchez's attorney says he believed he was under attack.
And we also learned some new information about the shooting.
Yeah, we did. We learned Sanchez started shooting almost immediately, within 3.8 seconds of being struck, according to Riverside DA Hestron. And we learned that he fired 10 shots. Four of them hit French, three in the back. One hit his father in the back, and also one hit his mother, leaving her in a coma for more than a week.
If I'm not mistaken, we thought he was knocked out for a second.
Yeah, okay. The defense attorney initially, attorney for Sanchez, said he was knocked unconscious.
Okay.
The DA made it clear yesterday that he was not.
Now, the DA released the store's surveillance video yesterday. What does it show?
Well, it appears to show French and his father moving away from Officer Sanchez, who is just off the screen. It also appears, to show French's father trying to push him away from Sanchez at the
time.
Okay,
so then why isn't Officer Sanchez facing criminal charges?
Well, the DA, Hestron, for his part, said he was deferring to the grand jury he had convened to hear the case. And he said he convened that grand jury because it can subpoena witnesses. And some witnesses did not want to talk to investigators, Hestron said, because of media attention surrounding the case. Hestron also said this is the type of case that demands citizen input on whether charges should be filed.
It's a case that where the public needs to weigh in and draw the lines and say, this is what we think about an off-duty officer using force.
A couple of quick notes about a grand jury. Proceedings, as you know, are secret. Only prosecutors present evidence. A defense attorney isn't even allowed in the room. Hence the well-known phrase in legal circles that prosecutors could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich they wanted to. But prosecutors are obligated to present exculpatory evidence. And Hestron said he solicited such evidence from Sanchez's attorney, who gave him medical records that showed Sanchez suffered a concussion. We mentioned that earlier. knocked out but did suffer a concussion, either when he was struck in the head or when he hit the floor.
Could the DA have decided to file charges himself even after the grand jury's decision?
Yes, he could have, but Hestron said he would not.
I think it would be disingenuous of me to take a case to the grand jury, present it, and then say, well, thank you very much. I'm not going to abide by what your decision is.
And Hestron said he didn't think he could convince 12 jurors to convict Sanchez if he couldn't convict 12 of the 19 grand jurors to indict him. And we know juries, grand or not, are reluctant to convict police officers. And it's probably worth noting that this happened in Riverside County, which is more conservative than L.A.
What's been the reaction from the Kenneth French family?
Their attorney, Dale Gallipo, says they're frustrated. He says he thinks Hestron took the case to the grand jury to avoid the politically sensitive decision of charging a police officer with a crime. He said his clients, French's parents, testified before the grand jury, but he wondered about the questions they told him Hestron's prosecutors asked.
Half the questions they were asked had nothing to do with the incident. They wanted to know about his mental disability, whether there were any prior acts of violence.
Gallipo called for the public release of the grand jury transcripts. He also says the family plans to file a federal civil rights lawsuit against both Sanchez and the LAPD.
Frank, were you able to get a reaction from Officer Sanchez?
I wasn't. He has not spoken to the media, but I did speak with his lawyer, Ira Salzman. He said Sanchez is happy about the grand jury's decision.
My client acted because he believed his son, a toddler in his arms, life was in danger. It's just a terrible tragedy.
Something else to think about here, A. Police watchdogs have raised concerns about off-duty shootings and the mindset of officers who are carrying weapons while going about their daily lives. Pasadena attorney John Burton is the former president of the National Police Accountability Project. He says off-duty officers can sometimes overreact to simple situations.
Officers who are off-duty sometimes forget that they're not wearing uniforms, and they see people who, let's say, shove them or whatever as being aggressive and defiant of their authority.
And the family's lawyer suggests that if Sanchez had not been a police officer, he would be facing charges.
Yeah, and John Burton agrees. He says that because Sanchez didn't need to shoot French and his parents to protect himself and his child.
When one uses more force than is necessary in a self-defense situation, that's well recognized in the criminal law, sometimes called imperfect self-defense.
Burton said an ordinary citizen would have been charged with manslaughter or even first-degree murder or at least assault charges in the shooting of French's parents.
So what did D.A. Hestron have to say about that?
Disagreed and focused instead on a standard used in virtually every officer-involved shooting. That was the standard set by the U.S. Supreme Court more than three decades ago. And that is whether an officer, given his experience and background, reasonably believes his life is in danger, whether or not his life is really in danger. And Hestron says he believed Sanchez believed his life was in danger, noting Sanchez told investigators he thought he had been shot, even though the only gunfire was his. And Hestron said it may not have been, it may have been a bad shooting, but it wasn't a criminal one.
So I am not condoning the shooting. I'm not up here saying it was fine.
Sanchez, I should note, still faces an internal investigation by his own department, the LAPD.
That's KPCC's Frank Stoltz on a Riverside County grand jury's decision not to indict the off-duty LAPD officer who shot and killed a man in a Costco in June. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, stop everything. California says to put down your vape pens, not in a little bit, right now. We'll tell you why when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Bye. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. More than 800 people nationwide have been diagnosed with vaping-related lung illnesses, and at least 12 people have died. That's according to new data out today from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. In California, 2 people have died. 90 have been hospitalized. And the CDC says the incidence of vaping illnesses has increased 52% in just the last week. The dramatic increase comes 2 days after the California Department of Public Health issued a warning encouraging people to stop vaping immediately. Ana Ibarra is a reporter with Kaiser Healthline News who has been covering this. Ana, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks.
Now, earlier this week, California's acting public health officer, Charity Dean, said a lot is unknown about this lung illness, which is why her agency is recommending people stop vaping. But what do we know at this point about what's causing people to get sick?
Right. So that's what the CDC and state health officials are investigating. What the CDC has said is that these illnesses are likely linked to some sort of chemical exposure, but what chemical that is still unclear. I know that there have been reports from other states like New York where they're linked some of these cases to vitamin E and some of the cannabis product samples they were looking at, but that hasn't been found in all of the samples yet. So they're still looking into that.
So because of the unknown, it's just kind of an umbrella recommendation.
Exactly.
Now, if health officials are unsure about what's causing it, on what basis is the CDC determining that these lung illnesses are caused by vaping?
Right. So they're going off some of the common factors, which is these similar symptoms plus these cases all have a history of vaping. It could be either vaping cannabis or vaping nicotine. In some cases, they're vaping both products. So that's the common factors they're seeing.
So both. That doesn't matter. Nicotine or cannabis, just so everyone knows, they're being lumped in together right now.
Yes. Right now, we don't know if it's just the cannabis products or nicotine, but they have reports of both.
So, is it common for vaping products to mix both tobacco and cannabis, or is it just that people who use vape use both?
I believe it's people who can use both, but they're mixing them. But my understanding is that they're using both products.
Now, within the last week, both the city and the county of L.A. have proposed bans on the sale of flavored tobacco products. What's your take on whether a ban is effective at protecting public health?
Yeah, well, I think that will be the big test. I guess we'll have to wait and see because, of course, the argument for the ban seems simple. You get rid of the flavors, you cut kids' access to flavors. But maybe it's not so simple because, you know, some of the arguments, even including from the industry, is that these bans only give rise to a black market and could make things worse. I think the idea is, you know, kids are already hooked and you can go online and find a recipe on how to make your own e-juice, for example, and, you know, that could potentially be more dangerous. We'll have to see how it works out.
Talking to Ana Ibarra with a California correspondent for Kaiser Healthline News. Now, according to a recent Reuters report, about 11 million American adults use e-cigarettes, more than half of them just under the age of 35. Is that a big part of the concern with this, Ana, is that so many people who are vaping are young and otherwise healthy by all accounts?
Yes. So, I think that is the big concern or a big concern. You know, the CDC has released some age data on the cases they're looking at. And I believe the last report I saw was about two-thirds of the cases they're looking at were people 18 to 34 years old, which, like you said, otherwise are pretty healthy.
And just to be clear, when we're talking about what's in the vape pens, we're talking about something that's highly addictive, right?
Yes. So these are e-liquids or e-juices. They contain nicotine or marijuana.
Now, where do these proposed flavored tobacco sales bans in L.A. go from here?
Yeah, so the L.A. County Board of Supervisors had a hearing on Tuesday, and they had a preliminary vote, and they have to come back at a later meeting for a final vote. The city of L.A., the city attorney, has proposed a flavor ban. That has to go up before the city council still, and we don't have a date on that yet, last time I checked.
You know, and as a health reporter who covers vaping, I'm wondering what information you'd like to see at this point. I mean, because there's so many things that we don't know so far.
Right. So I think the big question for us is, you know, we're
hoping to get answers soon on what exactly is causing this, because I think that will answer, you know, so many of the cases. It will give so many information to these proposed bans, cities and, you know, city officials, county officials who want to take action. Because really, I think that's the big question. Like, what is the substance or chemical that's causing these lung illnesses?
Anna Barra is the California correspondent for Kaiser Healthline News. Anna, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
These days, stand-up comedy has probably never been more scrutinized, and a comic's joke history, even if it's decades old, is now pored over and examined using today's sensibilities. So, how does a comedian stay active and funny for four decades? Well, we're going to ask one. Paula Poundstone joins the show, and Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. 2019 is comedian Paula Poundstone's 40th year of doing stand-up. And since there's no way to last four decades in a job and not be considered at least decent at it, she has more than surpassed that threshold. Over the years, Poundstone has also written books, acted, and been a political correspondent, always keeping comedy at the center of it all. But today in 2019, telling jokes on stage has a different feel, both for the person delivering them and the people hearing them. And the role of a comedian and how that job is defined has never been more scrutinized. That reminds me of the 1981 film History of the World Part 1, where Mel Brooks, as the character Comicus, waits in the unemployment line during the Roman Empire.
Occupation?
Stand-up philosopher.
What?
Stand-up philosopher. I coalesce the vapor of human experience into a viable and logical comprehension.
Oh, a bull artist.
All right, let's ask Paula Poundstone how that title holds up. On Saturday, September 28th, she'll be performing at Ace Hotel, presented by KPCC In Person. Paula, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you very much. It's so nice to be here.
All right, so what do you think? Because for me, stand-up philosopher has always been the perfect title for what comedians should be.
Oh, I don't know if I consider myself a philosopher. I feel like I do sort of reflect back things to people. One of my favorite types of laughs that I receive, one of the most healing laughs that I receive, is what I call the recognition laugh, where you say something that when it happened or when you felt it, part of the sting of it is that you felt like, geez, I'm the only one. Right? It made you feel lonely. In addition to whatever failure you may have had, you felt lonely. Yeah. And now you tell it on stage and, you know, hundreds of people laugh at it. It's very healing.
For you or for everyone else?
I think both.
Everyone, okay.
My son one time asked me, and I was kind of caught red-handed, really. He said to me one day, it just dawned on him. He said, "Do you talk about me on stage?"
Uh-oh.
And I was like, oh boy.
Because you I'm sure, right?
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
And I was like, oh, boy. It's like when a parent reaches around for the, in the old days, the Dr. Spock book. Like, oh, it's time for the talk. And I was like, really just like busted. And I went, well, yeah, I do, actually. And he sort of made a funny look. And I said, let me explain something. I said, you know, two things. Yes, I tell stories about us, but... Sometimes, mostly, I exaggerate for comic effect. I said, but the other thing is, if what I was sharing with people was so unique to us, then they wouldn't laugh. They'd kind of look at me sideways. They'd take a step backwards. I said, but what I'm telling them is something that happened to all of them, too, which is what makes it funny.
How easy, though, is that to do nowadays? Because it's almost like you're saying it's a general feeling for a general audience, but it seems like audiences today are very specific, locked into little boxes here and there. And if you say something that might bother someone here and might make someone laugh here, then you're not talking to everyone, I guess.
Well, I suppose you're right. But could there be culturally experiences that I have that another culture doesn't share? Absolutely. But I would still argue that we have more in common then we have differences. For example, we're all mammals. We breathe oxygen. We don't eat our young. And we have a podcast. All of us, right?
We all do.
Paul, when you started in 1979, how much did you worry or even think about offending people?
I did think about it because I worked with a pretty rough and tumble group of guys. And I used to watch, not that I haven't said something that inadvertently offended someone. I'm sure there's example after example of that. But I watched guys that went out and worked pretty clumsily, I think, to the audience in front of them. For example, I started in Boston, and then after, I don't know, a year and a half or so, I went to see him, not intentionally, but I took a Greyhound bus around the country to see what clubs were like in different cities. And I ended up in San Francisco, and I loved the audiences there. And I would watch guys go on and make jokes about gays that were, like, so harsh. And I would watch that, and I would think to myself, you know, there's a group of people in this room right now that are kind of the whipping boys constantly. And I want to make sure that when they come to my show, that they feel a part of the group as opposed to the people that we always make fun of.
Well, let me bring up Dave Chappelle, because his Netflix show, that Sticks and Stones, that hit a
nerve. Never seen him.
That thing hit a nerve with a lot of people because he joked about the LGBT community. He joked about Asians. And some comedians, Sarah Silverman, said, hey, that's comedy. You overstep. Others said he was racist. But there's one part of this special that a lot of comedians seem to agree on.
The next one's a little harder. I want to see if you can guess who it is I'm doing an impression of. All right, let me get into character. You gotta guess who it is, though. Okay, here it goes. If you do anything wrong in your life, and I find out about it, I'm gonna try to take everything away from you. And I don't care what I find out. Could be today, tomorrow, 15, 20 years from now. If I find out, you're finished. Who's that? That's you. That's what the audience sounds like to me.
Paula, how much should comedians be held accountable maybe for jokes that didn't work in the past or haven't aged very well? How does that work?
Yeah, there are no rules. Everyone keeps pretending there are rules. You know, sometimes as a comic, you know, you really are thinking fast and you throw stuff out there in the moment. Sometimes I do it like in a rhythm. You know, it's like if I respond at a certain pace, it almost doesn't matter what I say, so long as I get it in with the right timing.
Yeah.
And people sort of laugh. And maybe when they look back on it, they go, well, that wasn't really funny. But it was funny because of the rhythm of it. And sometimes I do blurt things out that I don't think I've ever said anything that I was like, boy, I wish I hadn't said that. Well, one time I did. But I don't think it's just comics. I just think in the world in general, there is a gotcha feeling right now. And I think that every human being deserves for people to look a little deeper in their experience with someone.
There's that gotcha, and there's also the cancel culture. Well, you said it, and we're canceling you now forever. You can't ever be a part of us anymore.
Yeah, which, by the way, eventually what's going to happen with that system is if everybody has to go into the cancel circle, right? So there's a big circle that's all of us. But every time somebody makes a misstep of some sort, says something that someone doesn't like or that can be considered, you know, racist or sexist or homophobic, and they have to go now into the cancel circle. What's going to happen is that eventually the big circle of all of us will be empty.
Now, your podcast is called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. What kind of things do you
talk
about?
So I can say anything.
So that's the reason why you call it that?
Yeah. Oh, you should hear the accent.
No one listens to me. So here, I'm going to say this.
Right, yeah, right, exactly. It's me and my partner, Adam Felber, and I never describe it very well.
Well, no one listens to it. No one listens to you.
So it doesn't matter. We have a Facebook page, and on the Facebook page, we offer, for the listener who can come up with a compelling but succinct description of the show, we offer a fresh bar of hotel soap.
Nice.
Because every time I do like an interview, I go, well, it's a, you know, it's a podcast. Every show is not the exact same, but we usually have a guest who presents like an authentic guest, often professors who present information that's helpful to have as a human being functioning in the world. The most memorable for me was a plumber because I could remember what the plumber said. Yeah. And then me and Adam make things funny. That's really the basis of it.
One of the things, though, I mentioned a lot of titles up top that you've done in your career. Rapper. Now I got to add rapper, right? Because on the podcast, you last week put your new rap song. You debuted it. It's called Not My Butterfinger. We're going to go out on that song. But before we do that, tell us the story of why you wrote the song Not My Butterfinger.
Well, one of the fun things about doing this podcast has been just having the opportunity to find out about different things. You know, different subjects that I'm interested in, or get somebody who's an expert on that topic, to come in. And so I had at one point gotten a professor of music, like some sort of musicology guy, to come in and talk about rap, which I didn't always, I'm not an aficionado of in any way. Like, I've heard some rap songs and some of them I kind of like. So I just wanted to know more about the genre. So we had this guy come in, and then he was really interesting and fun and a great guest. And so then I started thinking, well, what if I had somebody come teach me how to write a rap song? And so we got a wonderful guy, a producer named Jay Deal, and Jay Deal came in to talk to me about that. And in order to do so, I have to come up with some lyrics. And one of the things that had really been bothering me, and I talked a lot about on the podcast, is that Butterfingers, I bit into one day enthusiastically the way one would.
Yeah.
And it was inedible. And I'm looking around on the package.
A Butterfinger, inedible.
Yeah. I'm looking around on the package. And then I saw the Red Corner new improved recipe.
Oh, boy.
They are inedible.
Wow.
And so I started to write lyrics about Butterfingers. The point of the song is, in a world with so many challenges, why would someone feel the need to change Butterfingers, right? Don't we have more things going on?
Paula Poundstone is performing at the Ace Hotel September 28th, presented by KPCC. In person for tickets, go to kpcc.org/events. Paula, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Oh, my God. New improved recipe.
I'm sorry?
I'll miss a crispity, crunchity fun size, but what are you thinking? Wouldn't it have been wise? Consider my sister, consider my brother. Stop the gun violence, stop shooting one another. Cruelty to the transgender. I don't get it. It's such a mind bender. That needs a correction, but Butterfingers don't need a new direction. Change our type of fuel. Make a powerful public school.
And now, a goodbye. The Fun Factory has been at Redondo Beach Pier since the early 70s. Part carnival, part arcade. It's tucked into a warehouse-like space underneath the boardwalk. And it isn't exactly the most up-to-date around, though many locals love its grittiness.
All the future generations and kids around here, like, I feel like they need to know, like, that this was here.
That's Hannah Tallman, who grew up in Redondo Beach and wanted to show it off to us in our series 88 Cities. The Fun Factory has been struggling to survive, however, ever since city officials announced plans years ago to renovate the pier, meaning longtime businesses would have to go. Owner Steve Shoemaker resisted for as long as he could, but just this week he announced that the Fun Factory will officially close by January. He posted a letter on the city's website saying, quote, "I feel sorry for the 3,687 people who signed the petition to stay open. I feel sorry for the boardwalk businesses, which will suffer because the attraction is no longer there. And I'm sorry that a half century of work ends like this," end quote. According to the Fun Factory's outgoing voicemail message,
"Our last day open will be January 5th, 2020. Thank you.
Fun Factory, it's been fun, and thank you while it lasted. All right, that's going to do it for Take 2. If you missed any part of the show, what were you thinking? We're on at 2 o'clock every day, but there's a way to hear it. Just go to wherever you get your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2, we'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.